The overall objective of today's lecture, today's lectures, will be addressing different objections that some would have against the Bible. We live, especially in this area, in this community, where people would like to question and raise objections to its validity, to its authenticity, and to other issues concerning it. And so in this first lecture, we'll be considering, is the Bible a reliable copy? This will be a lecture. I'll explain more about this in just a few moments, but we'll be addressing the question of whether or not this book that we have in front of us has been accurately preserved through the past couple thousand years. How accurate, how confident can we be in that? Secondly, we'll be discussing, is this Bible, is this this work historical? Are the events and the claims that are found within it accurate? What happens when we measure the claims of the Bible with historical proof and data? Does it measure up? And then the third and fourth lectures will have to do about the content of the Bible, looking at perhaps alleged contradictions or certain moral objections that people maybe could bring up when it comes to the content of the Bible as far as what its claims, what's its doctrine, what's its teaching. So the method of persuasion in this morning's lectures, at least my lectures, will not be of giving you some brand new fact or detail that you never heard of before. That's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to be sticking to the facts and to the data that is agreed upon by the majority of all scholars in these fields. And so I'm not going to be sharing some secret conspiracy that's been hidden from us by our government or by some secret agency. But what I will be doing is by using facts and using data that virtually all scholars, whether they are conservative, liberal, atheistic, skeptical, Christian, all agree upon, and then making a case for what is the most likely conclusion we can come to using just those facts, using that data. Okay, so before we kind of jump into this, I want to say a few things about the Bible just as way of introduction. First of all, the Bible means books. And so some people think that the Bible is just one singular book. It's incorrect. The Bible is a collection of 66 individual books. And we learn that they are written in different various genres and styles. Some of it is historical narrative, some is legislative law, poetry, some of it's even written correspondence between people. So it's not just one style, but it's many different books in different styles. It's also written in two different groupings. There's a division. There's an Old Testament and a New Testament. Primarily in these next two lectures, we'll be looking at the New Testament. One of the biggest proofs and most convincing proofs for the authenticity of the Old Testament is first building a good concrete foundation of the authenticity of the New Testament. And I'll explain more about that in just a moment. It's written over a span of 1,500 years, from about 1500 BC to into the first century AD. So over many, many different years. It's also written by 40 different authors. And these authors are all very different. They all have different jobs. Some of them were kings. Some of them were shepherds. Some of them were fishermen. Some of them were tax collectors. Some of them were religious leaders, so on and so forth. It was also written in three different languages. The New Testament that we'll be primarily examining today was written in Greek, but the Old Testament was written mostly in Hebrew with a few sections of Arabic. And also is a best-selling book in history. It's estimated that over 168,000 copies of the Bible are either sold or given away on a daily basis around the world. And so this is a very widely spread book. So these are a few things I want to notice for these. So what we're going to be doing today is looking at four different objections that people would have about the authenticity of the text. People would have about it, whether or not the text that we have in our Bibles today are the same as what was originally written back in the first century. So I'm just going to give you a quick preview here of these things. The first objection, we don't have any original documents. So we'll talk about that in a moment. What about the time gap between the original writings, the original documents, and our first discovered manuscripts, copies? And thirdly, aren't there alterations, aren't there discrepancies among these manuscripts? I mean, don't they say different things? How can we trust them? And then fourthly, why are there so many different Bibles today? I mean, you go on Amazon.com or you walk into Barnes & Noble, want a Bible, and there's tens of them and dozens of different Bibles. Why are there so many different types of Bibles today? And how can I be sure that I have the right one? All this. So we're primarily going to be looking at this first objection and this. First of all, I want to say something, make something clear here. A few things clear. I'm not going to be, in this lecture, arguing for the inspiration of the Bible. That is my position. I believe the Bible is inspired by God. But what we'll be doing today, or at least in this first lecture, is not looking at whether or not this word is actually from God. All we're doing is measuring it scientifically and historically to see if we can know for certain or have reasonable confidence that what was written in this book is the same that was originally written 2,000 years ago. The same thing that we would kind of view other books, like C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. No one would ever say, yeah, those books were actually true, those things actually happened. But everyone agrees that that writing, those books, was originally written by C.S. Lewis during the time that he lived. That's a similar test that we'll be putting through the Bible here, and we'll build upon that as the day continues. Okay, so what do I mean by we don't have any original documents? A couple words that you'll be hearing me say a lot through these next 40 or so minutes is the word manuscript. What's a manuscript? A manuscript is a handwritten copy by a trained professional. Okay, so back then they didn't have a printing press, and so the only way they could preserve texts was through manually writing out and copying the documents that they wanted preserved. And so we have lots and lots of manuscripts, which again are handwritten copies by trained professionals. Not just anybody could write a manuscript, but a trained professional would write these manuscripts here. And also, if we have a copy of something, that means there must have been a what? An original. Okay, that's what I mean by original, by an autographed document. So we have 27 books in the New Testament, so that means there must have been 27 books that were originally written and penned by its original authors. Now, this might be news to some of you, but we don't have any original document of any of those books. We don't have any book, either Galatians or Romans or Matthew, that actually has the autograph of the author there. All we have are copies. All we have are manuscripts. And some would say, well, that since we don't have the originals, therefore we cannot know for certain, we can't have confidence that what we have today is accurate. All right, first of all, I want us to consider when and to establish when the originals were written. It is a consensus view that all the New Testament was written between the years 50 and 100. Now, some conservatives, and even myself, would think that maybe even some of these books were written even prior to 50 AD. But even the most skeptical scholars would agree that all the New Testament was written and completed by 100 AD. And they're written during that time span of 50 to 100. Why do they say that? They say that because of early extra-biblical sources, like Clement, Polycarp, Ignatius, Justin Martyr. These are just a few of the early, the end of the first century sources that quote from and reference the New Testament. So between these three or four authors, 25 of the 27 books of the New Testament are quoted from or referenced by year 110. So if they're quoted from, and if they're referenced by 110, that means they must have been written prior to that. That's just one small reason why this is a consensus view. And there's many other reasons we can go maybe deeper into that. Well, why don't we have the originals? Why don't we have these autographed copies? See, they didn't preserve their documents like we do through a flash drive or through a floppy disk. It's my dad's favorite method of saving information. But it was saved and it was preserved through writing on parchment or papyrus or papyri. And this is a very perishable material, and so we can understand why it wouldn't have preserved 2,000 years. And in fact, most of our papyri that has lasted that long had to be from a very dry area. Most of our oldest manuscripts are from the Egypt and Africa area because it's so dry, it would be easier to preserve through time. That's why we don't have them today. Let's weigh the objection. Is it reasonable for us to assume that since we don't have the original manuscripts, therefore we cannot know and we cannot trust the copies? Is that a reasonable objection? The truth is, when we think about it, we trust copies every single day, don't we? If you drove here, you drove in a copy. You drove in a replica. The vehicle that you drive, that many of us have, isn't the original prototype of your, Chevy Cruze or your Dodge F-150. No, it wasn't. But in fact, it was F-150. Goodness. But it's a copy. It's a replica of that. And by the fact that you've gotten here safely, I'd say it worked pretty good. And so we trust replicas. We do this every time we open a book. I doubt any of us here have actually read an original book that was actually penned or typed out by the author. But we trust and we rely upon the copies and the replicas that we have. And so on and so forth. Even like another way of illustrating this would be, our government has foreign policy conversations and discussions with foreign nations and leaders who don't even speak the same language as we speak. So what do we rely upon to get our information to them and to have a conversation? We rely upon a middleman, right? And that middleman is a translator that communicates back and forth. And this can be done extremely accurately. So for us to say that we can't trust the middleman, or we cannot trust at all a copy or a replica, isn't really consistent with that. But I know what maybe you're thinking. Well, we've all been burned by replicas before, right? A friend of mine, he was in some secondhand shop, and he found some of these earbuds, and they were Beats earbuds. They're really expensive, like $100 a piece, brand new. And he saw them, and they're $10 each. And so he bought five of them because, well, I can resell these. These are really, nice, really, really expensive, earbuds for a super discounted price. And so he bought them. And then he's listening to them, and they're like, they're really bad quality. And they looked at them closer, and there was a sticker that someone put on there with the brand name. So really, the replica wasn't really a replica. It was false advertising, right? Another friend of mine, these weird friends, I guess naive friends, that was bought a backpack on a street vendor. And it said North Face Backpack. And North Face is a really great brand of backpack. And so he bought this backpack. And then sort of falling apart, the strap, came unstitched. And then he realized that someone had actually stitched the North Face sticker or brand onto this, generic backpack. And so should we trust every single copy, every single thing that claims to be just like the original? Well, no. Okay, so Dan, what's our options? What's our, alternative here? So we shouldn't discount every single replica, but we also shouldn't accept everything naively. So what's our alternative? We need to investigate and search out each replica to make sure that it's reliable, right? So we need to do a little investigating, a little researching to know that this can be true. And that's exactly what we're going to be doing today. We're going to be looking at the manuscripts, the copies of the New Testament, and we'll be seeing, is there evidence, is there data for us to believe that what the manuscripts are representing, what they're saying, can be relied upon? And that's going to be our goal and our objective as we follow through this. So that's kind of the answer to that objection. So that objection is not an absolute statement that we cannot agree on, we cannot know for certain anything if it's a copy. We can, but we need to make sure it's warranted by researching it. Okay, so the second objection we'll be looking at here, and we're about to get a little bit technical here, is what about the time gap between the originals? Again, the originals are the original autographed documents of each one of the 27 books, between the originals and the discovered manuscripts. So, okay, yeah, so we have copies, so we have these manuscripts, but some people would say, and kind of shoot from the hip and say, well, but they weren't written until hundreds of years after the originals were written, so therefore, how can we know that they're telling the truth? We can't know. Well, let's look more into this. This would be a similar objection that someone would have if the only witness to a crime scene stood like 500 feet away. Imagine a crime happened and the only person testifying about what happened stood 500 feet away. Is that a good witness? No, it's not a very good witness. He couldn't see maybe very well. He's very far away. Is that true when it comes to the New Testament witnesses, these manuscripts that testify to what the New Testament originally said? Very few of us have done perhaps much research into the writings of antiquity and are familiar with the methods of determining the accuracy of these manuscripts and of these copies here. But let me just kind of share with you what I've learned about them. It's very similar, this evaluation and how they come to this realization, how they come to these conclusions, it's very similar to that of a court. where you have an issue, you have a crime, you have something, a situation that a court or a judge or a jury is trying to determine what is the truth, what happened. And so what evidence does a court rely upon to find out the truth about those things? You have forensic evidence. What else do you have? You have eyewitness testimony. Okay? Only in this case, when it comes to textual criticism, which is what we're about to do here, we don't rely upon people telling us what happened or what's the truth about. We're relying upon manuscripts. They are, for sake of argument, our witnesses. But is every witness created equal? Is every single witness hold the same weight? No, not at all. And so the court has three basic, and same things with textual criticism, which what experts apply to these manuscripts to figure out what the truth is. It has three basic rules of witness evaluation. Okay, this is what a judge or a jury or a court is looking for to determine the truth about something. First of all, multiple witnesses are always better. A single witness is not really as preferred or sufficient because you can't compare a story with others. And so what would keep him from making up something, right? So multiple witnesses can be compared, cross-examined, contrasted. And if many witnesses testify about the same thing, then we can be more certain that what they're saying, what their testimony is true. And it can also be used to kind of weed out maybe a single false testimony. Okay, so the more witnesses, the better, right? The second thing, high-quality witnesses. So let's say you have 500 witnesses, you have 1,000 witnesses, you have 20 witnesses, but they're all at a really low quality. What do I mean by that? What if you had a witness who stood far off? Maybe a witness who was drunk at the time, maybe a blind witness. Is that going to be a very reliable source? Is that going to be someone that you're going to hold his testimony very strongly and very heavily? Not very much. But if you had someone who was sober, lacking a criminal record, someone who had really great eyesight, someone who was really near to the event, someone who was mentally sound, an upright citizen, educated perhaps, this would be a person that would be of more high quality. A more high quality witness. And thirdly, differing witnesses. Now, I didn't say differing testimonies, but differing witnesses. Imagine you have multiple witnesses, and they're all close by, but they all have roots into this really bad neighborhood gang. All right? And so they're all connected. There might be some likelihood that they all kind of got together and kind of conceived an idea or made up a story that all of them were repeating the exact same thing. So you have multiple witnesses, they're all close, but they're all from the same demographic and place. But what if you had multiple people, and they all had differing backgrounds, came from different neighborhoods, different social classes, different races, different political views, different...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I didn't hear your name.
My name is Dan.
Dan.
Yeah, Dan Cain, K-O-E-N.
You did offer us to share back and forth, correct?
Yeah, well, mostly during the break periods. And so right now I have a lot of material to get through, so I'll kind of present that, and then we can discuss maybe in the break periods, if that's okay.
Okay, so you take questions after
this. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So if you have different people from different demographics, different backgrounds, and they all say the same thing, they all have the same testimony?
The only reason I said it, because this sounds like the disciples. They came from different backgrounds.
Yeah.
And so it sounds familiar.
You're beating me to the punch. Yeah, we'll talk about that, absolutely. Sure. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So if they're all from different backgrounds and all saying the same thing, then that means they're differing witnesses saying the same testimony. That's thumbs up. We like those. Okay. So let's apply this evaluation, this criteria, to the New Testament witnesses, and that is the manuscripts. These are the copies. All right. These are copies. These are witnesses saying this is what the New Testament said. So let's see. Does the New Testament have multiple witnesses? Okay, so does the New Testament have multiple copies, multiple manuscripts of it? And in order for us to kind of understand, okay, what's a good number, what's a bad number, we need to compare it with other writings of antiquity. So let's compare it with Herodotus. Herodotus was a Greek historian, wrote about the 4th century B.C., 4th, 5th century B.C. We have 8 handwritten, professionally trained copies of Herodotus's writings. Julius Caesar, his Gallic Wars, written about the same time period of the New Testament, maybe 100 years before. We have 10 copies, manuscripts, 10 witnesses of his account. We also have 645 copies of Homer's Iliad. Iliad's kind of a Greek historian slash, he loves a lot of mythology, Greek mythology. A lot of what we know about that is found in Homer's Iliad. We have so many more of his. You know, historians absolutely go giddy when they see how many copies and manuscripts we have of Homer's Iliad. Aristotle, a philosopher, we have 5 copies, manuscripts of his. Plato, we have 7. Now, we don't have any original, you know, autographed documents of any one of these writings. But what do we have? We have witnesses. We have these manuscripts and copies of what they said. So put your historian cap on. What do you expect when you're looking at a writing of antiquity? Well, how many copies do you expect to find? With the exception of Homer, you're looking at around 10. If you have 10 copies, that's really good news. It's really good. It's very reliable. So let's compare what historians are used to seeing when it comes to ancient books of antiquity with the New Testament, strictly the New Testament. We have 4,500 discovered manuscripts. I kind of almost wish this was a smaller number, because it just looks ridiculous on the page, doesn't it? Like, you got to be counting this kind of strangely or weirdly, because it just doesn't make sense. You can't be right about that. Check your numbers. I was thinking about giving you some references for some books to research, but these facts are so well known, just Google it. Just Google how many manuscripts do we have. This number will come up. All right, I'm not finicking with the details or anything like that. So we have 4,500 handwritten, trained professionally written copies of the New Testament. So, does the New Testament have multiple witnesses? Yeah. Okay. So let's apply the second criteria. Does the New Testament have high-quality witnesses? So earlier we determined that high-quality witnesses in a court would mean, all right, good record, upstanding citizen, had a clear line of sight, good eyesight, these sorts of things. Well, how do we determine the quality of a manuscript? We determine the quality of a manuscript by how soon it was written to the original. Okay? So basically, the closer it is written to the original, autographed, to the original, which we agree is 50 to 100 AD, the better the quality is. Okay, so again, let's compare these other same writings of antiquity with the New Testament. So Herodotus' writings, the earliest copy that we have of his writing was written 1,400 years after Herodotus actually wrote the book. So 1,400 years. So that's generations of, copying, passing on, copying, passing on, copying, passing on. And our earliest copy was written 1,400 years after that. Julius Caesar's was written, the earliest discovered manuscript was written 1,000 years after he wrote that. Homer's Iliad, again, standing head and shoulders above the rest, 500 years. This is, again, kind of unbelievable and really, exciting to historians when they see only 500 years. Aristotle, 1,400 years. Plato, 1,200 years. So if you're a historian, what do you expect to find when you're looking for the time gap between when the originals were written and our first, discovered written copy? We're expecting anywhere from 1,000 to 1,400 years, typically. Okay, let's compare the New Testament. The New Testament, we have the entire New Testament preserved in a single book, within 250 years after the originals were written. Comparatively speaking, the quality of these witnesses are above any other writing of antiquity. And we even have a fragment of the New Testament, just a few words, but it's authenticated as being a New Testament manuscript that was written 25 years after the completion of the New Testament. This is kind of ridiculous as far as how well documented this is. But it goes even beyond that. We have 15,000 translations of the New Testament from the 7th century backwards. So from the 1st to 7th century, we have 15,000 translations of the Greek. These are all just Greek here. We also have, and this is also a neat fact here. Remember how I said that manuscripts had to be professionally trained handwritten copies. Well, guess what? There are some individuals who were not professionally trained at writing manuscripts, but what they would do is they would write down a verse here and there, or they would make quotations. And these people were called the church fathers or the early church leaders. So, if you're a preacher in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd century, what you do is you'd write a sermon, you'd write your notes, just like any of us would. And you'd quote the text. And so from these quotations of these 1st, 2nd, and 3rd century Christians, we have 32,000 quotations just from the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd century there. Even if we didn't have any manuscripts, if we only relied upon these quotations, we could reconstruct all of the New Testament except for 11 verses. All right, so do we have lots of witnesses? Yes. Are they high-quality witnesses? Yes. Are they differing witnesses? Okay, how am I going to do this here? So the differing witnesses, all right, if they're all from the same place, if they all had a common agenda, then maybe we can't really rely upon them if they have a common testimony. That's kind of the idea there. Okay, let's consider this for a moment here, where we have this map, and this is most of the civilized world at that time. And I also notice some of these. Remember, I mentioned these early Christian writers, these early church leaders who had these quotations. These are where they're from. We have Justin Martyr, who is in Rome. We have Tertullian in Carthage near Africa here. Polycarp in Smyrna, Clement in Alexandria near Egypt, Marcion in Sinope, Ignatius, who lived in Antioch, and then you also have Alexander, who is from Jerusalem. Now, I also notice a few things about these men. These men all classified themselves as being Christians, but they are absolutely nothing alike, all right? So their moral code, I think even Marcion, he was a pedophile. So he was a real bad guy. Some of them had feuds with one another. They believed different doctrines. They believed different interpretations of the Bible. They lived in different areas. They spoke different languages. They're so different. So what's my point? My point is, even though they had different agendas, and even though they had different languages, they had different beliefs and doctrines, they all, whenever they quoted the New Testament, their quotations would match up. They're quoting from the same Bible, even though their beliefs were very different. So that tells us that if their common testimony, their common quotations of the New Testament are all the same, they're probably telling the truth. So that's kind of a neat thing. That's for free. Okay, so let's look at this third objection. Aren't there discrepancies among the manuscripts? So we have these manuscripts. We have so many of them. Yeah, they're really early. But Dan, I heard that there are a lot of discrepancies. There are a lot of differences when you look at these manuscripts. So let's see if that's true. Yikes. Okay, so research shows that there are, when you count them up, and this is even kind of a conservative number. Some people think even more than that. But for sake of argument, there are 150,000 variants in our discovered copies, in our discovered manuscripts. So there's 150 things that are different about each one of them. So they don't look very unified at first glance. And so this is really troubling to us here. This is really worrisome. How can we trust this when there's so many different discrepancies and variations among the text? First of all, I want to say something here. Numbers can sometimes be misleading. And so we need to investigate them. For example, this is a survey or a record that was published in the U.S. World and News report in November of 2001. And in this report, it was it's pretty clear there. It's recording the complaints of the customers of different airlines. And so you have six different airlines there on the tool. And so they gather together all the different complaints and put them next to one another. And at first glance, what do we think? That what's the worst airline, the most complained about airline? United. That's the worst, right? So none of you ever going to fly United, right? Or American is the second worst, and then you have Delta. So, okay, those are the worst. And what's the best? Alaska. Okay, never fly anything but Alaska for the rest of your life, and you'll be reset. Maybe some of you are kind of thinking, there might be something more to the story. See, one detail they didn't include in this record, in this numbers, and in the statistic, is, how many more passengers did United Airlines have than Alaska? See, if you have more passengers, the likelihood of you having more complaints goes up. And so really, this is not a very telling statistic at all, really. So is that true? Perhaps is that true when it comes to 150,000 variations? Let's look closely to see if this really is a reason for concern. Okay, so we have to apply textual criticism. It's a nice, fun word for us. So basically what textual criticism is what we do is we look at all the different texts, we look at all the different manuscripts, and then we compare them here. Okay, so really there's three different steps when it comes to textual criticism. And I was going to give a really detailed account of this, but then I was getting lost in my own head. I was like, you know what, this is getting kind of wordy here. So I'm just going to give you a summarization of this. And I've done more research on this. So if you're really excited about this, then this is one of those things you can ask me about later. So the first thing they do is they classify the manuscripts. So we have a 4,500 manuscripts, but not every manuscript is created equal. So, for example, would a 12th century copy hold the same weight as a 3rd or 4th century copy? Not at all. And so first thing they do is they divide up the manuscripts into different classes, all right? Higher quality, sooner written, later written, etc. Secondly, what they do is they classify the variants. Not every variation is created equal. Sometimes it's just a change of grammar or a change of accent, or there's just a change of wording there. Sometimes it's just like skipping a word, skipping a line, repeating a lines. These are all things that we do in our own writing. And then thirdly, what they do is they cross-examine each individual verse throughout the entire New Testament. That's the general process there. And even in today's copies, you ever read a book and it has a typo? Even in the age of a printing press. My grandfather loves the old Western books. Zane Grey is his favorite. He has tons of these Zane Grey Western books. And he'll just sit there with a pen in his hand because he's looking for those typos. And this is like a fun activity for him. I don't know. And he finds the typos. And he'll find them even in a printing press. I Googled this because I was kind of curious. Harry Potter, Hunger Games, Twilight, these are all famously known for some really kind of, dorky and kind of silly variants in between them. But we don't say, oh, well, look, one or two variations, therefore I can't trust that this book is written by J.K. Rowling or whatever. Let's do a little exercise here. So here, let's say these are four different manuscripts. And this is from Philippians 4, verse 13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And each one of these, there is a variant. Do you see it? Right, it's the word thing, so you have the hashtag mark there. Pound sign. And there's a variant in each one of those. But is the accuracy really in question about what each one of these are saying? No, because they're easy to notice. Even though there's a variant, it's not difficult for us to cross-examine them and see, okay, the most likely reading of that would be, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So this is kind of a small little summary of the textual criticism. So what does all that result in? When we apply that to the New Testament. Okay, that's our number. 150,000 variants. Whew. Okay, how do we get the reason around this number? How do we figure out and see if this number really is what it seems to be? We can get rid of 95% of these variations by doing one thing. Eliminating the non-authoritative manuscripts. So every manuscript that wasn't written in the early centuries, so just the later century, the later written manuscripts, if we just get rid of some of those, this number goes down to 7,500. Just like that. We can cut this number down another 95% by doing something else. By taking out all the errors that are simply orthographical. What do I mean by that? Orthographical differences would be the difference of an accent or of grammar. Because just like our English language, there is variation within time. In the Greek language, you had different accent marks and different marks that were applicable for grammar. But as that changed throughout time, so the copyist, so the scribe, would also update the grammar. And so the people making this number, they counted those. Thanks a lot, guys. So if we discount get rid of those errors, we have 375 variants. a lot more manageable than the previous number. But we can do even better than that. Out of this number, we can get rid of 58% of this number if we simply look at the variants that are really easy to know what the truth is. So remember that Philippians 4:13 example? How easy was that to figure out? Like, any of us could do that. And we never even took in a class in that, all right? And so if we simply look at the easy-to-determine differences, variants, we can cut this number down to 150. But we're not done yet. Okay, so out of this 150, we can cut this number down 67% by just getting rid of the non-substantial. I'm going to tell you what I mean by this. Non-substantial differences. So there are some words that we're not really sure which one was the original. But there are some differences that doesn't really matter. So a non-substantial difference would be the difference between the word child and the word youth. Not a big deal. We can live with that. That's not going to make any difference really to us at all. So if we apply that, we're down to 50 different variants. And this is down 0.03% from our original number. And so this is pretty impressive. So, okay, what about these 50 variants, though? Is that the reason for so many different denominations out there today? Like, each one picks a different variant? No. Each one of these variants that are difficult to determine have no bearing or difference upon any doctrine in the Bible. So there's really no difference for them. Westcott and Hort, textual scholars, said that that among this number, there is not even one article, one affected article of faith or precept of duty which is not abundantly sustained by other undoubted passages or by the whole tenure of Scripture teaching. So scholars say, you know, even if you look at these 50, there's really no big differences. It's not going to change the way you live. It's no difference of doctrine among them. Okay. Let's look at this fourth objection that we would have. Why are there so many different Bibles today? Again, this is what happens when we maybe we want to buy a Bible. And so we go to Barnes & Noble or we go to a bookstore, and there's just dozens of these different translations. You know, you have the ESV, the NIV, the King James, the New King James. You know, you have all these different translations, and you're like, well, wait a minute. I thought, you know, there weren't any variations, and how come there's so many different types of Bibles today? First of all, I want to say something real quick. The vast majority of all translations, essentially every single translation or version, they translate from the exact same reconstructed Greek and Hebrew text. And so basically what I mean by that is the difference between a English Standard Version Bible and a New American Standard Version Bible or the New King James Version Bible is not that they're all translating from different variations of the reconstructed Greek text. They're all translating from the exact same Greek Bible into English. Okay? I just want to mention that real quick here. The only exception to this would be the Catholic Bible uses and includes the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha is about 14 to 15 intertestamental books, books that are written in between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Mostly these books are pretty small, and they're just stories or historical events about characters. All right? This is some quick facts about these. It's interesting that if you look at the quotations of Jesus and the apostles, they quote almost every single Old Testament book. But it's interesting that they never quote from any of the books of the Apocrypha, which maybe makes us think that maybe that wasn't even included in the Bible during the time of the first century. So maybe it's been added since then. A second thought is that both Jews and early Christians didn't accept these writings as included in Scripture. In fact, the earliest that we really see them being added or considered is maybe like the 4th century or so. And so these were kind of added on later on. Now, I will say this. The difference between the Catholic Church and the Protestant is not because, well, the Catholic Church listens to the doctrine of the Apocrypha. There's really no doctrinal difference and not doctrinal bearing or on your life if you accept the apocrypha or not. Now, I want to be very careful, because I'm a Christian, and I want to make sure that I keep the Word of God as being what was intended to be. So I'm going to be careful to inspect that. But really, there's not going to be a huge amount of doctrinal difference and variation between if you include the apocrypha or not. So, I'll say a few things about the Gnostic Gospels. There's been a lot of debate and talk about this since the Da Vinci Code book and movie was released about this. I have more to say about this, so if you want to talk about more about this later on, maybe we can discuss these things. But I will say this. Mostly those who argue that the Gnostic Gospels, such as the Epistle of Barnabas, the Gospel of Judas, the Apocalypse of Peter, etc., etc., most of the individuals who argue that they should be included have not actually read them. That's really my prescription for those who think they should be included. Read these books, okay? Because what we the proof that we have for the 27 books of the New Testament are very firm, as we've discussed. So those, without a shadow of a doubt, I think can be looked at as being reliable, as being accurate. So what do? Exact same thing we did with the textual criticism. We cross-examine. So if we cross-examine the story and the events of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and compare them with these Gnostic Gospels, you're going to find a very different Jesus and a very different story. Which one is wrong? Because they cannot both be right. And from there, I think you'll find out the evidence is more heavy for the canonized Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But if you're in doubt, read them, and I think they'll become clear to you. Most people that have read them soon realize, you're right, this doesn't really make sense. It's not really very reliable. We'll talk about that later. Okay, so that's the disputed books of the Bible. So we have the next question we'll address this real quick here in our last minute or two is why are there so many different translations or versions of the Bible? Most of this has to do with translational philosophy. See, when a translator or a group of translators are wanting to translate any material from one language to another, there are some objectives and some goals. First of all, there's accuracy and then readability. After all, the purpose why it's being translated is that so that people who could not read it in its original language can now read it in their own. So readability is a good goal. And so, but the problem can sometimes arise when we sacrifice readability for accuracy. And so really what we're looking for, we're looking for a translation of the Bible, is we're looking for as close as possible to a word-for-word translation. Because if we don't do that, then what we're left with is a thought-by-thought. So basically, the Greek was written in a different way and has some different words. Anyone who's bilingual in here knows the fact that there are some things that you have to kind of add a word or add an idea, not really an idea, but add the context to something when you're translating something else. And so the major concern that we want to have when we look at different translations is how accurate were they and how diligent were they to preserve the word-for-word accuracy of the text that they're copying. And this is really easy to do. Basically, go onto the website of these different translations, and they'll tell you different translations. So translations that take a very conservative, very literal approach to the Bible would be King James, New King James, American Standard, New American Standard, English Standard Version. Kind of list goes on and on. I'm not going to list all of them here. But these are Bibles that take that very literal perspective. There are dangers when we go the opposite direction. The dangers of a version that paraphrases is that it is guided not by the translator's skill in simplifying, but by the clarity of his understanding of what the author meant by his theology. So let's see that in a different way. So the translator, when you're translating it and you're trying to be as readable as possible, sometimes what you do is you translate your own interpretations into the book. And me, as a Bible student, I want to do that for myself. And I want to be as independent as I can, not relying upon another man to translate what he thinks the Bible says. And so that's one thing to think about that. But really, the majority between most translations are simply synonymous. They're mostly the same. They maybe use different words. You might argue, what's the difference between the word great and the word awesome? Some difference of connotation, you know, perhaps, are different ways there, but really it's not a large difference. So really we can be sure these are not real big ideas. But again, do your research. And most of the time there are forums online and different books you can investigate to see what is a good translation to use. Okay, so these are the four objections that we talked about. I think the evidence that we have to answer these objections is sufficient. So we'll now have about a 10-minute break before we jump into our next lecture, in which we'll be investigating the content of the Bible, seeing if the claims and the events of the Bible can be trusted when measured to historical accuracy.